the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, we hope. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg.
In the first half this morning, a conversation I had with digital restoration expert Andy Saunders. He brings the 1960s Gemini and Mercury moon missions vividly back to life in a new book with incredible photos, Gemini and Mercury Remastered.
And then we speak with physicists Sankita Marukar and Rowan Thompson, and they reveal how their team is merging physics, health sciences, and bioinformatics for the revolutions in cancer treatment with precision, personalized care.
That all coming up this hour. You're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak. Today's guest is Andy Saunders. He's the author who unearthed rarely seen images of Apollo, and his new book, Gemini and Mercury Remastered, takes us back 60 years to the missions that paved the way to the moon. These early flights were raw, risky, and profoundly human. Long before smartphones or modern computers, astronauts and engineers solved life or death challenges with sheer ingenuity and grit. Andy brings us this history in stunning visual images. And today he'll bring those to life in sound right here on the radio. Andy Saunders, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, we'll do our best, and thanks for having me on.
It is wonderful to have you on, and this book is so captivating for any space enthusiast or just those who, like myself, I often get messed up on the timeline of which mission came first and which was for what purpose. So why don't you take us through a quick timeline of all three missions? We know Apollo came last, but what were they for?
Yeah, so Apollo Remastered, my first book, was about the Apollo missions, as the clue is in the title, about the missions to the moon. This is, I call it the prequel, because it is about those missions before Apollo, some of which, as you say, people don't know that much about, particularly Project Gemini. So this is Gemini and Mercury Remastered. Now, the title's a bit misleading because that's chronologically incorrect. Mercury, of course, came first. So this was these one-man missions in these tiny capsules, and the objective was simply, you know, can we get a human into space and back alive. But within 3 weeks of the very first Mercury mission, so that was Alan Shepard's MR3 mission, that's when Kennedy made his quite extraordinary commitment to land a man on the moon by the end of the decade. So it was then really largely down to Project Gemini, which were these larger capsules, longer missions, two-man crew, that were really responsible for proving, you know, can we even do this? So proving a lot of the key techniques and spaceflight techniques that would be required to go to the moon. For example, can we then keep people alive long enough for a journey to the moon and back, 8 days? Can we maneuver in space? Can we meet up in space with two spacecraft? So rendezvous and docking. Can we exist outside a spacecraft? Can we design a suit whereby we can leave a spacecraft and exist and work in this most hospitable environment that we know? So that was all what Project Gemini was all about. And it's incredibly fast paced, 10 missions in just 20 months, each one building on the last, really pushing the boundaries. People that read the detail in the book alongside the imagery, I think, would be quite shocked at just the level of risk that were taken. And so they're just bursting with human drama. So I want to do just that, to put all these, the Mercury, Gemini and Apollo all in perspective, and we can follow along actually every single mission from launch to splashdown and learn that arc that got us to the moon.
It's just fascinating. And I just want to mention, you dedicate the book to the early space pioneers from the US and also the Soviet Union who lost their lives in these pursuits.
The Apollo 1 fire, of course, between Gemini and Apollo, The prime crew of Gemini 9 were sadly killed when they flew their jet to where they were going to actually do some testing. Actually, they crashed into the very building in St. Louis where their spacecraft was being constructed. They were going to do some testing there. They flew, the crew of Bassett and C flew in one jet, and the backup crew of Gene Cernan and Tom Stafford flew in another jet. There was bad visibility at the airport or the landing strip. C kind of banked left. Stafford went up, which is apparently what you're supposed to do to try again. And C sadly caught the building and they were tragically killed. So that bumped Cernan and Stafford up to the prime crew of Gemini 9. And actually what then transpired on that mission was, I mean, how Gene Cernan got back in his capsule from what he called the spacewalk from hell, you know, all this detail is in the book. Like, again, the risk they were taking. But yes, sadly, people were lost during the pursuit of the moon.
How many astronauts were involved in the missions?
That's a very good question. I mean, the 24 moon voyages, so these are, I guess, the astronauts that we all know, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Jim Lovell, Gene Cernan, had their first missions on Mercury and Gemini. There were 10 Gemini missions with two-man crew. Some flew twice, such as Jim Lovell, John Young, and then Mercury, of course, there was famously the Mercury 7, although only 6 actually had a flight. I'm not sure the exact number off the top of my head.
That's fine. Well, the big push with Gemini, of course, was to beat the Soviets, right? Because the Soviet Union was at a very fast pace as well to sort of be the first to the moon. And so with Gemini, when you talk about the mad pace, that was a big part of it, right? At one mission every couple of months. That is, that's crazy. At a time when we didn't even really know, I mean, we knew that missions could happen, but we didn't really know the outcome of what it would be like for these astronauts, right?
Yeah. An incredibly fast pace and risks that you wouldn't take today, but that they just had to because it was a race. I mean, when you then got into the Apollo missions, I mean, even Apollo 8, you know, they gave the crew a kind of a 50-50 chance of coming home. You know, today you can't give someone a 50-50 chance. It needs to be 99.9%. And when people say, why haven't we been back to the moon since? We've got all this modern technology. That's part of the reason. It's still very dangerous. And to get to 99.9% takes a lot more time. It takes money, whatever the technology. So, yeah, these were those missions that were pushing those boundaries and taking those risks because it was felt that it was just essential to catch up with the Soviets. And it was probably during, I would say, Gemini 6A and Gemini 7, that first rendezvous in space when the US really started to overtake the Soviets in that race. You know, to be able to maneuver in space and perform the first rendezvous. The Soviets kind of tried to claim a first rendezvous, but actually their spacecraft wasn't capable of maneuvering in space. So when the two spacecraft passed within about 3 miles of each other, it was more just good timing and aiming at launch. The Gemini capsule was the first real spaceship. It could maneuver. So Gemini 3, the first orbital maneuver in space happened with Gus Grissom and John Young. And like I say, 6A and 7 was the rendezvous. 8 was the docking, another vital step in how we can get to the moon. So that was Neil Armstrong. A lot of people, your listeners may know, he almost died on that mission along with Dave Scott when the spacecraft tumbled out of control. So like I say, there's just all of this human drama and all of this risk to try and catch up and then overtake the Soviets. And interestingly, there wasn't a single Soviet mission. The whole Gemini program was conducted without the Soviets making a space flight. So that really was the time when the US caught up, if not overtook, in the race for the moon.
Right. What happened to the Soviets during that time?
They didn't develop the next level of spacecraft. And like I say, it is only 20 months. You know, it's hard to get our head around this time frame of how rapid, although there were 10 missions, and although they did so many firsts, the first US spacewalk, like I say, the world's first rendezvous, docking, and perfected all of these techniques, they achieved so much, but it was in such a tiny window of time in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, it's funny. Now it's hard to keep up with all the launches that SpaceX does and everything that they're doing, because it seems to be blasting forward at such a, you know, breakneck pace. But really, Gemini was very similar, you know, one mission every couple of months.
Yeah, and only one launch pad that could launch the Titan II. So when they wanted to do this rendezvous, which it was originally going to be with an uncrewed target vehicle, that went wrong. And so they had the idea of, oh, okay, let's try and have two crewed spacecraft meet in orbit. But there's only one launch pad. So what they had to do is launch Gemini 7 out of sequence first. This was going to be the first really long duration mission. Jim Lovell was on that mission, but a 2-week mission. So they had to launch that mission, get the next rocket ready for Gemini 6A really quickly and get that launched in order to meet Gemini 7 in orbit. So such a rapid turnaround, not just these missions, but of the pad, you know, that we tend not to see today.
I always return to that story about, I think it was Frank Borman, who was in one of the Gemini missions, and his entire goal was to beat the Russians. And then, is it true that he was then offered to go to the moon for the first moon landing and he turned it down because he didn't really care about that so much? He just cared about beating the Russians. And then he went and spent most of his life on a cattle ranch in Montana.
Yeah, that is, it's certainly how the story goes and how I understand it. Of course, Borman was on Apollo 8 with Jim Lovell and Bill Anders. So actually he was one of the first three humans to leave Earth entirely and voyage to the moon. Although they didn't land, you could argue that mission is just as important as the first landing mission. So he'd also achieved that. And yes, he had his Gemini mission too. So he was on with Jim Lovell on Gemini 7. And this was this 2-week marathon in this tiny capsule that they say is like the size of the front seats of a VW Beetle. Two men for 14 days. And, you know, you think you can't even stretch your legs. I know I couldn't do it. I mean, I couldn't even put the suit on because I'm claustrophobic. So then to strap yourself on top of that rocket inside this tiny capsule and stay there for 2 weeks was just, you know, a different breed.
Yeah, maybe the space more than anything inside the capsule was what turned him off. I mean, I think about that sometimes when I'm in a tight space and I think about, imagine if you were, you know, engaged in space exploration, this would be what it would be like. Well, let's reintroduce you. Andy Saunders is my guest today on Cool Science Radio. We're talking about his new book called Gemini and Mercury Remastered. This is a prequel to Apollo Remastered. That was his first book. So let's get to that word remastered. I understand there are about 5,000 photographs that you have collected here and chosen from, and then remastered. So what does that mean in this case?
Well, yeah, they took 5,000 photographs during Mercury and Gemini. The first project you mentioned there, Apollo Remastered, there were 35,000 photographs, so a lot to get through. There was about 10 hours of the 60mm movie film as well. So there's two things that I do with the imagery. So the key to the still images that are in the book that have been remastered is to use actually the original flight film. So this is the film that was actually in the cameras during the missions. So this is film that had been locked away in this frozen vault in Building 8 at Johnson Space Center at Houston for half a century to maintain its condition. So everything we've seen since has actually been based on duplicate film, lower quality copies. Then there'll be a copy of a copy. Then in the analog world, someone would request a photograph, so they'd need an internegative of the copy of the master of the original. And then we see the image. And so every generation, there's a degradation in quality, and it goes on and on and on. And now in the digital world, that's got worse because someone will put a JPEG online, someone will copy it and resave it and put it on social media. And it just goes, it just hit me that to me, the most important photographs ever taken are actually being seen in a progressively worse state as time goes by, but they're being seen by a progressively bigger audience. And that concept drove me nuts. So the opportunity to go back to the holy grail of film made out of that freezer and to be able to use those raw files, they look very dull and lifeless and often underexposed and appear to have little in them straight from the scanner. But when we apply some time and some digital processing to them, we can see they actually contain a huge amount of visual information just waiting to be revealed. So just applying some time and some modern digital processing to that film means we can now see these important moments in history like never before.
Yeah, I'm looking right now on a photo, actually, probably, it says, taken by Frank Borman, who we were just speaking about, of Africa, pictures over Africa. And it's quite detailed and quite a wonderful photo. And I'm wondering about the quality of the photographic equipment that was used. It's my understanding that the astronauts were told, of course, you know, they're the only people out there taking the photos at this point, but they have a lot of other things to do, like, you know, saving their own lives. So the priority of taking a photo is probably low. However, some of them did. So can you describe what kind of photographic equipment they were using?
Well, right back at the start of the book, we start with, of course, with Mercury, so the very first missions into space. And actually, NASA wasn't keen for the astronauts to take a camera at all. They were far too busy. These were short missions. They didn't want to distract the astronaut with photography. And so there would be a camera on Alan Shepard's mission and Gus Grissom's mission. There was a camera mounted in the window that automatically took photographs. When we moved to the first orbital mission, so John Glenn, he said, no, I want to take a camera. People are going to want to know what it's like to be an astronaut. I'm going to see things no human's ever seen before. He spotted this $40 camera in a drugstore after a haircut, actually, when he was training at Cocoa Beach. And he said, he bought it. He said, I want to take this on my mission. So it was adapted with a pistol grip so he could point it out of the window. And with it, and this is in the book, you know, the first photograph of Earth from space taken by one of us. I've also found the moment he took it, so we can see him take it and we can see the resulting photograph. So it was often the astronauts that kind of drove the desire to take photographs. The Soviets, for example, Alexei Leonov, he took a pad and some coloured pencils. He wanted to draw sunrise and sunset from above the atmosphere to share those stunning colours with people back on Earth. As we got into the Gemini programme, the photography got a lot better. It was actually Wally Shearer who took the first Hasselblad camera. So this is a medium format, incredibly good camera, Zeiss lenses, actually on his Mercury mission. But that's what was used really from then, but predominantly through Gemini, through Apollo, and even into the shuttle mission. So you could interchangeable lenses, you could have interchangeable magazines, so you could use different film types. But the turning point for space photography was Gemini 4. So Gemini 4 is really the heart of Gemini Mercury Remastered book. The photography in there is absolutely stunning. It was the first US spacewalk. And so when these photographs came back of a human form of Ed White floating in the void against the backdrop of Earth, those photographs really wowed the public. And NASA realized, oh, we can get the public excited, we can get continued congressional support. So from then on, there was more funding, better equipment, more training. And you'll probably see throughout the book, as you get towards the latter Gemini missions, the photography does seem to get better because they were training more. They had a super wide camera as well on the last three Gemini missions, which was also an incredible camera, which sadly didn't make it to the moon. I wish it did, but they did use it on Gemini, and the photographs taken with that camera are just absolutely stunning. They have like a very unique aesthetic, the early spaceflight photographs, particularly those in Gemini. I think it's just the way film, the warmth and the tonal range of film captures that era. And what a subject matter for a photographer. You know, they've got this super jet black sky. You've got the super bright white sunlight. It's not being filtered through the atmosphere. So you get this huge dynamic range. I was lucky enough to get the input from some of the early astronauts to make sure I was processing these images correct. Because when I was doing it, I thought, gosh, these look absolutely incredible. Am I pushing the processing too hard? But in fact, I wasn't. The visual in space is very specific. It is very stark. There's no atmospheric haze. And so we have this absolutely stunning imagery, particularly on those latter Gemini missions.
So again, starting with Gemini 4 is when they introduced more advanced photographic equipment. And were the astronauts trained in photography?
Not a lot in the first missions. They were when, say, the Weather Bureau. You imagine this is the first time we had photographs of Earth. So there were all manner of requests then when NASA realized and other bureaus realized, wow, we can use this for mapping. We can use this for meteorology, as we do today with satellite imagery. We can use it for oceanography. We can use it for all kinds, looking for Earth resources. And the military, of course. So when NASA started to get these requests from like MIT or the Weather Bureau, they were given a bit of training to say, look, this is what we're looking for to capture, and this is how you use this particular type of film or camera. But they weren't generally trained, certainly not to the extent that they were on the Apollo missions. But as we progressed, like I say, from Gemini 4 onwards, they did start to train much more with the cameras. They were longer missions. They were more, you know, used to being able to spend a little time taking those photographs. Back in the early days, a funny story. So Gordon Cooper was a really keen photographer, and he actually would pretend he was asleep so that he could take more photographs. So he would literally just tweak the thrusters very lightly so the ground didn't notice any extra fuel usage. So it wouldn't give the game away that actually he wasn't sleeping as he was meant to do. He wanted to stay awake to take these photographs.
Wow. It's incredible. Yeah, as the book goes on, as you keep turning the pages, the photographs just become more amazing. Now, when you said when you were processing them, I'm not a photographer, and I don't know about the process, but what's the difference between processing and remastering then? I mean, are you processing them from the original film? You're coming up with another new photograph that is an original. Is that right?
It's still the original, a scan of the original film, but they just, those scans are really, they're almost just like data. They're not visually interesting. Because if you think of what a scan is, it's like a digital photograph. And if you think of what it's taken a photograph of, it's a piece of analog film. So anyone that remembers, you know, negatives from a camera, although these weren't negatives, they were kind of a positive. You remember the very dark, the very low contrast. But applying digital processing techniques to them, because those scans do capture that data, we can use digital processing techniques to pull out that detail and present them correctly as we always should have. Now, it's important to mention there's absolutely no AI, no artificial intelligence-based processing used on these. These are historically important images. And so everything has been done, you know, my objective is not to reimagine or reinvent. It's to bring clarity, to reveal what was always been there and inherent in that film. It's just about peeling back the layers of aging and duplication and degradation and noise to reveal what was always inherently in that film. But we can now see it because we can apply the digital processing to it. The other technique that I use, so a lot of the images you'll see in the Mercury missions are, you can see the astronaut, and because that was actually taken with a 16mm movie camera. So the other technique that I use, and I use this first to produce a clear image, the first clear image of Neil Armstrong on the moon with this technique, was to, the 16mm film is very small format, inherently very noisy, but what I do with that is I separate that movie film out into its separate frames, potentially 1,000 frames. And then when you stack them on top of each other, perfectly align the signal, which is the image that we want. What we basically do is we strengthen that signal, which is the image, but we don't strengthen the noise because the noise is in a random place on every frame. So the long and short of it is we can pull out things that you can't see in one frame. All of that information comes into one. So it's not AI. Everything that's in that is in that original film, captured by the lens of that camera, but the results are really quite striking. So we can see down to the level of the pores of the skin of, you know, John Glenn as he's re-entering the atmosphere, not knowing if he's about to burn up because he's just been told his heat shield may have come loose. So we can now see, you know, the faces. We can see their anticipation before launch. We can see their focus, their exhaustion, their awe as they look out the window at these, you know, and now we can look out of that same window at this stunning view of Earth. And that's what this stacking technique on the 16mm movie film is really great at showcasing.
Well, Andy Saunders is my guest. He's one of the world's foremost experts of NASA digital restoration and author of the best-selling Apollo Remastered. His work has been exhibited internationally, and he's now back with this new book, Gemini and Mercury Remastered. It is a fantastic book. I can't wait to get into it a little more. Andy Saunders, thank you so much for joining me on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me on.
Andy Saunders. And let me tell you that if you are a fan of the moon missions, and if you are someone who loves a great coffee table book for all of your guests to look at when they come over, that is your book. It's hard to describe via audio how wonderful it is visually.
Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
Our guests today are two professors who are spearheading a multidisciplinary effort in physics, health sciences, and bioinformatics to redefine radiation therapy, making it more precise, safer, and tailored to each patient's unique cellular response.
Dr. Rowan Thompson is a professor in the Department of Physics at Carleton University and holds the prestigious Canada Research Chair in Radiotherapy Physics. She earned a double honors Bachelor of Science in Math and Physics from Carleton and her PhD is in theoretical high energy physics. How about this? Specifically, super string theory at the University of Waterloo and Parameter Institute.
Dr. Sangeeta Murukar is an associate professor at the Department of Physics at Carleton University. Her expertise lies in Raman spectroscopy and multimodal nonlinear optical imaging applied to areas such as skin cancer detection, cellular responses to ionizing radiation, and radiation microdosimetry.
Welcome to you both. Thanks for being with us.
Drs. Thompson and Murukar, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio today. So, Dr. Thompson, radiation therapy has been a mainstay of cancer treatment for more than a century. And I'm just curious, from your perspective, what do you think are the biggest strengths and where does it fall short today? I mean, what are the benefits and where can we do better?
So the benefits are that it's extremely effective at curing cancer and controlling it. Treatments are very effective, can be relatively inexpensive. And with technology evolution over the last 20 years, we're improving our ability to target tumors and limit radiation exposure to surrounding healthy tissues. One challenge is personalizing radiation therapies, so making them connect directly with what an individual patient needs. And this happens on multiple levels, some of which we're addressing through our research. So some of my research, I work on simulations on the physics of these cancer therapies, and we try and model individual patients instead of, say, assuming they're a big bucket of water. And so therefore, we're able to better personalize the treatment to that particular patient. Another aspect of our research together is to try and work towards biological response. So every individual will respond to radiation in a different way. And we're hoping that through more research and evolution in the technologies, we'll come up with methods to be able to understand how an individual will respond to radiation. And this could then be used to inform the treatment. So tremendous progress. But again, there's still a long way to go to optimize these treatments for individuals.
So I have a very limited background in your field, and I'm just fascinated by this because back in the old days, and really not that old, but I do remember when they were using cobalt treatment. I don't know if it's familiar to you, but that was really just a big ball of radiation. And then the huge progress leaps forward to using the gamma knife and other types of therapy. But again, it seems to me that we are treating patients, as you said, one bucket of water. I'm not aware that we really have had this kind of breakthrough where we're talking about looking at individual responses to radiation therapy.
Yeah, so you're talking a lot about the technologies for actually delivering the radiation, right? So huge improvements over the last 75 years, right? Going from cobalt therapy to the new linear accelerators, gamma knife, and all those types of technologies. Often patient treatment plans are more and more being adopted directly to the patient. But what they're often not taking into account is how is that particular patient going to respond to the radiation? And so you might imagine in the future with the technology that I'm developing with Dr. Murugar, is a way to test how will an individual patient respond to the radiation. And so then we could tailor the treatment to the particular patient. Are they a responder? Are they resistant to radiation, for example? How sensitive are their healthy tissues to radiation as well?
So you have experts coming from multiple fields. And Dr. Murugar, one of the things you've been working on is detection in terms of using really advanced optical technology and innovation to be able to, if I understand correctly, not only detect, but during the treatment of radiation, to pinpoint exactly in real time how the patient is receiving the radiation. Did I get that right?
That's the conceptual idea. So yes, we are developing this technology so that in the first place, we are using light as a non-invasive technique to identify what are the signatures of response to ionizing radiation. So this technique that we use, it's called Raman spectroscopy. And what it involves is we shine near infrared light. So imagine this deep or red laser shining on this collection of cells, right? What we are looking for is how this color of light changes. So because this incident light interacts with the molecules, it comes when we look at it, collect the scattered radiation and look at it with our detectors, we can actually correlate what are the differences in intensity that we see at these different energies in the spectrum. You know, so similar to a spectrum that you see when you have light shining through a prism, for instance, right? So we get this signature of different colors, which are even deeper red than the red light we shine at, shine the sample at. And then looking at these differences in the intensity of this light at different colors, we are able to then correlate it with changes that are present in the sample. So in this way, we are able to say, okay, this signature is that of cells which are irradiated versus cells that are not, right? Or and for to do this, of course, like you said, we have to use smart computer algorithms to tease out these very small differences. And so it is indeed a multidisciplinary effort here. So we use bioinformatics as well, so data science. So a collaborator of ours is also involved in this study. So yeah, at the cellular level, this is what we are able to see. And then going forward, this will be developed into a technology that can be then applied to tissue, as well as maybe in the future, the patient.
So it's unfortunate that most of us have either had a run-in with cancer ourselves or a loved one, someone we're close to. And so I think everyone has a cursory knowledge of both chemotherapy and radiation. And Dr. Thompson, I'm just wondering, you know, as you were talking about, we've done a good job at throwing a bunch of radiation at the issue. And I think this technology has been advancing for a while now, where you're trying to get more precise pinpoint treatment. And then what you all are doing in terms of detecting and seeing what's happening to the tumor as you're applying the radiation, how much is that going to alter how we feel after a radiation treatment? I mean, we know that radiation really makes people
sick, but also is more of the sort of long-term effects that are negative for someone undergoing cancer treatment?
Yeah, so some of the work I do relates to calculating radiation dose to better plan treatments. And again, this relates to the bucket of water model versus actually modeling the patient. What we found is that when you use the conventional approach for planning these treatments and evaluating them, you're missing out on a lot of the physics. That means that the patient dose or energy that's deposited in them is not the same as what's actually delivered. And so for one type of breast cancer treatment, this means that the skin is receiving a higher dose in reality compared to what they're currently using in cancer centers. And so what happened is doctors were looking at outcomes for these treatments, which are excellent. However, patients are experiencing side effects like skin reddening. It's very uncomfortable, takes time to heal. There could be complications from that. We're developing calculation approaches that enable the treatment team to accurately predict the dose for different patients. And that means that a physician could say, oh, we're going to change how we're going to treat this patient a little bit, so that they are less likely to have this secondary effect, okay? So they're less likely to have complications. So that's one of the goals of our research, is to better plan and evaluate the treatments so that patients can have better quality of life, so they have fewer side effects. And this is economic benefits as well, right? Because there's less strain on the healthcare system if they don't have to go for repeated visits.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, our guests today are two professors who are spearheading a multidisciplinary effort in physics. We have Dr. Rowan Thompson, Dr. Rutgar from Carleton University. And this is just absolutely fascinating. I want to go back to something you said, Dr. Thompson, about the predictions and modeling. Now, I'm very familiar with Monte Carlo simulations that we use in financing all the time. You know, how do we predict the outcome of certain investments and risk? I'm very curious how you are applying this to your predictive modeling for outcomes in cancer treatment.
Yeah, it's a great question. So we do Monte Carlo simulations of radiation transport. Same ideas as in finance, in that we're using random numbers to determine what happens. But in our case, we're loading a whole lot of physics knowledge into those simulations. Okay, so we use random numbers to determine what interactions take place in a patient. But that's still, you know, baked in there is knowledge of the fundamental physics that's happening within this patient. So if an electron or a photon is moving through the patient, they're interacting with different tissues, different materials. We have a lot of physics in these codes to predict how the radiation interacts and where energy is deposited. That's our first step, is the physics cell. Then we can take that further and start to apply other modeling, so radiation biology modeling, to try and predict outcomes. So there's multiple stages in this, going from the physics more to the biology and connecting with patient treatments at all stages.
That's just fascinating that we can use these types of predictive modelings that we're currently using a completely different field of study, that we're now flipping it on its head and now applying it to actual outcomes in cancer treatment. That's something I am fascinated by. Was this something that your team developed or came up with? Or was there other research already out there that you kind of grabbed onto and said, hey, this could be kind of an interesting way of doing predictive modeling?
Yeah, so Monte Carlo simulations are used very broadly in medical physics, which relates to radiation treatments for cancer. They're the gold standard method. So lots of researchers use this. The innovations for my group come from implementing it very accurately and with speed for certain treatment types. And the treatment type that we've often looked at is a treatment called brachytherapy, where there are radiation sources implanted in the patient directly. So we developed one of the fastest and the only open source code in the world that's available. But Monte Carlo techniques are used very widely.
Very interesting. Dr. Murukar, I'm wondering if what you're developing with the Raman spectroscopy, is that going to, can you apply it to other parts of medicine? Even something like how
chemotherapy as being effective or not? I mean, when you're using it, are you looking specifically at a tumor itself and seeing how that is reacting toward it, or how the tumor is reacting, or you're going so deep at such a cellular level? It would seem that you can use this broadly across lots of different applications. Can you talk to that?
That's a great question. The technique is very powerful. As you mentioned, the basic effect is that what we are looking for is changes in the spectrum. And so as to identify what are the signatures of the response. And so this response can be from, say, cancer cells, which how differently, whether they are responsive to the treatment or not, right? Resistant or responsive. They could be from cancer cells which have been treated by chemotherapy, for instance. It's not limited to radiation therapy. So we have, in fact, in the past showed that ovarian cancer cells, when we investigated using Raman spectroscopy, we were able to differentiate between ovarian cancer cells which were chemo-resistant versus chemo-sensitive. And we have done a number of such studies in which we also applied to, for instance, HLE cells. So these are cells from the eye, the lens of the eye. And there we were looking for the response of these cells to very low doses of ionizing radiation using, again, Raman spectroscopy. And again, that has implications for, in this case, for radiation protection, right? So in certain cases, say, for instance, in occupational exposures. So we have been talking about, treatment and treatment planning, et cetera. But the flip side is occupational exposures or accidental exposures, right? So workers in nuclear power plants who are maybe exposed to low doses, but on a recurring basis, so low doses of radiation, but chronic exposures. So in such cases, we do want to identify what are these biomarkers of exposure to low dose of radiation. Because if we knew that, if we can do that, then it will inform radiation protection policies as well. So this is something we have shown, that our technique is also capable of identifying what are the signatures of response at low doses.
Wow. Dr. Thompson, you said something a couple of minutes ago about the way I heard it was, not implanting something, but it made me think of some proactive way of detecting cancer cells or the proliferation of cancer cells. Are we there yet where we're able to say you have a BRCA gene or something like that, and you have a very high chance of getting certain types of cancer, that you can go, that the technology is such that you would be able to go in and identify the proliferation of cancer cells before it even happens? Is that too wild to even ask about?
So that's not my area.
okay.
I mean, what I was talking about is in this type of treatment called brachytherapy, radiation sources are implanted in the patient. That's for treatment, not the detection. So I don't work on that detection angle. So I'm not a good person to be quoted on that.
Okay. Well, thanks for that clarification, because if for someone who already has cancer, and then you're able to go in and do this targeting, it seems like with the application of technology and the innovations that we have, that there's so much better use of precision and personalized medicine. Do we think that ultimately, I mean, obviously this is going to have much better outcome, but
does it increase the predictability of cancer at all?
That's what we'd like. We'd like to move to a phase where we know better based on the science and the data how to treat an individual patient. So in my view, that's the purpose of a lot of this research. It's the purpose of accumulating large data sets and developing novel techniques to understand how individuals respond to radiation is so that we can know for a particular individual how to best treat them to have the best outcome in terms of tumor control, best outcome in terms of limiting complications. And those are for that individual, but they're also for their family, for their friends, and even broader society, right?
So I would like both of you to take a stab at this, because what we've been talking about is a lot of the work that's happening right now at the cellular or computational level. And I just would like your take on what do you think are the next steps or maybe even the biggest hurdles in moving these discoveries into actual hospital treatment plans for patients, where you were just talking about this personalized therapy, which is groundbreaking in radiation therapy. So I'd like each of your takes on what do you think are the next steps or biggest hurdles that you're facing in moving this into the clinical world?
All our research is at different phases, right? So I have some research with Monte Carlo simulations where we're calculating doses for brachytherapy. And right now we are working on moving a tool that we developed at the university called Eggs Brachy. We are actively working with collaborators across Canada who are in hospitals at implementing it for patient treatments. And initially the process for this is to retrospectively analyze patient treatments that have already taken place, learn from them with a view towards hopefully implementing the new technique in the future for planning patient treatments. This takes time because the whole medical treatment team needs to get used to the use of the new technology. We may need to revise prescription doses. We may need to revise tolerances for tumors at risk. And so this is a iterative process that certainly takes time. And then there's a role for professional societies, such as the American Association of Physicists in Medicine, to then, you know, make suggestions on how, and professional guidance on how these treatments should happen. In terms of the technologies that Professor Murukar and I are working on together, those are still in much more of an exploratory phase. There's going to be a lot of work to take that into clinical practice. And there are lots of issues in terms of, you know, how big is the apparatus. But I'm going to pass that over to Professor Murukar because she is best positioned to answer that.
Thanks, Rowan. In terms of developing portable technologies, right? So that's, so my team is really interested in that. We have developed compact platforms, which we are hoping that, and we are working with a commercial or an industry partner in Ottawa to make those even smaller. So we hope that Raman spectroscopy would be in the format where it would be deployable at the site, whether it's in a hospital setting or in terms of if we're looking at occupational exposures, then in field, right? So that's something we are actively working on. We are also developing a technology based on pulses of light so that we can get images, and those images would actually, so we have used these really short pulses of light to do rapid Raman imaging. And what that gives us is an image that is not only showing the structure of the tissue or cells, but it also gives us chemical information. So it's chemical imaging. And this is without adding any extra labels or, you know, so totally label free. And again, that is something that we have miniaturized in the past. And this is something that we are very interested in developing, are these small platforms that we can then deploy in the field. So yes, we can definitely see ourselves working in the future together with, you know, say Rowan's group and also teams in radiobiology, for instance, our collaborators there, bioinformatics, and then deploying such a technique in the field.
Wow. The future looks bright, I think, for radiation therapy and cancer treatment. Doctors, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio today. Lynn and I genuinely appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. Until the next time, stay curious.
Thanks to our guest today. First, Andy Saunders. He is the digital remasterer, or shall we just call him the expert at digital remastering with his book, Gemini Remastered. Very interesting, beautiful book. And Rowan Thompson and Sangeeta Marak. Oh, now I can't pronounce her last name.
Marukar.
Marukar, thank you. Precision medicine, really interesting. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you have an idea for a story here on Cool Science Radio, give us send us an email, coolscienceradio@kpcw.org. As always, you can find our archive shows on our website, kpcw.org, under the Shows tab in Cool Science Radio, or wherever you get your podcast. It's KPCW Cool Science Radio. Oh, we have a moment to talk about our guests for next week's show on Thursday. First off, we talk with science journalist Stephanie Pappas. Very interesting. She's a journalist for Scientific American. And?
Yeah. And then we are going to follow that up with a conversation with author Mary Roach. She's the best-selling author of, I believe it's called Stiff and Fuzz. She'll take us on a wild ride through the strange, ingenious, and sometimes...
sometimes wild, wacky ways that we replace body parts.
Wow.